Support for this public radio podcast comes from Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org, and by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's more to the Federal Reserve than just Ben Bernanke and interest rates, you know. In all, there are 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, each and every one of them chock full of economists trying to figure out what the heck is going on. The Philadelphia Fed spoke up today, and you're not going to like it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management. Online at shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, February 21st. Great to have you here. Although there is not much great to tell you, folks, what we had today was a peek at the future, the Index of Leading Economic Indicators from the Conference Board. Just like it sounds, it's supposed to give us a hint of what's ahead. 3 to 6 months is their frame of reference. And for the fourth month in a row, the index has dropped. It's now off just as much as it was right before the recession of 2001. The news from the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia fits right in that time frame. The Philly Fed's Business Activity Index came out this afternoon. Again, just as bad as it was right before the recession of 2001. Oil traders supplied their own informal indicator today. Crude tumbled 1.5 on worries about an economic slowdown. We've touched base a couple of times recently about auction rate bonds. That's the market that state and local governments have been going to raise money at relatively cheap interest rates. The auction rate market is short term, which means investors wouldn't have to tie up their money for too long. Until recently, it was pretty reliable. But Marketplace's Bob Moon reports the credit squeeze could mean the end of it.
This is just the latest chapter in a crisis of faith spreading through the financial markets. It seems everybody, from wealthy individuals to big corporations, has just stopped believing in this type of short-term bond investing. Now there are signs the once attractive market doesn't have a prayer.
I think the auction rate securities market is dead and gone.
Attorney Jacob Zemanski specializes in securities issues in New York. He says he's been getting calls from investors who've been trying to get out but are being told they can't.
I'm hearing from investors who are unsophisticated and some very sophisticated investors. They're astounded that their brokers are telling them now they can't get their money out.
Zemanski says the bond issuers have relied on banks as buyers of last resort, but the banks are now refusing to make good and investors are left holding the bag.
On their monthly statements, it usually lists these auction rate securities as cash equivalent, like a money market. So people that thought that they were in short-term cash to pay bills like tax bills that are coming up to buy a home don't have access to that money.
The bond issuers are scrambling to get out of the market, too, since they're on the hook for high-interest penalties. Paul Rosenstiel is California's debt manager. He says the state is desperately trying to refinance.
What we're hoping is there's going to be some way that those bonds get converted to a fixed rate over a long enough period of time that it doesn't create a glut in the market.
High demand for refinancing could lock in higher rates for years to come, and Rosenstiel says in the end, taxpayers will be footing much of that bill. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
For once in a very long while, some big losses at a major investment bank cannot be laid at the feet of subprimes. The bank in question is the French group Société Générale. Most of the red ink it reported today, about $5 billion in the most recent quarter, can be blamed on rogue trader Jerome Kerviel. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more on the biggest trading loss in the history of banks.
Société Générale actually made a profit last year of $1.3 billion, but fund manager Justin Urquhart-Stewart says no one finds that result reassuring.
If you compare it with last year's, it is a drop of over 80%. That's a huge drop, just showing actually what size of an explosion that torpedo caused.
The explosion was a total trading loss of $7 billion. The bank claims that Kerviel alone was responsible. Kerviel says his managers knew what he was up to. An internal report just published concedes that SocGen's managers were negligent at the very least. They ignored 75 warning signs that Kerviel was trading illicitly. Sophie Pedder of The Economist magazine in Paris.
It does look increasingly as if the Kerviel's superiors must have known, and if they didn't know, they should have done.
There's a fascinating detail in the internal report. In 2006, the junior trader earned a bonus of $40,000. A year later, he got $200,000. Peter Hahn is a former investment banker.
If I recommended somebody who worked for me to have that kind of increase, my boss would have a very serious conversation with me saying, how has he improved his performance so much? And his activity would normally be scrutinized in great detail.
Kerviel, according to the report, had actually asked for an even bigger bonus of $400,000. When the trading scandal broke, he insisted he'd simply been trying to excel as a trader and was not motivated by personal gain. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
John McCain's turning today's article in the New York Times to his advantage. He's trying to raise a couple of bucks off it in a fundraising email that went out to supporters this afternoon. Hillary Clinton's a little short on cash herself. Barack Obama outspent her 4-1 in Tuesday's Wisconsin primary. We learned last month she was forced to lend her campaign $5 million out of her own bank account. But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports some wealthy Clinton backers think they can help.
If speeches could create jobs, we wouldn't be facing a recession. But it takes more. As Senator Hillary Clinton passed legislation to bring investment and jobs to struggling communities and work to...
Check out this ad that just started airing in Ohio.
Sounds like a campaign ad. It looks like a campaign ad.
Fred Wertheimer heads Democracy 21, a campaign finance reform group.
Reasonable people are going to conclude it's a campaign ad.
But the Clinton campaign didn't pay for it.
Paid for by American Leadership Project, which
that's an independent political group, or 527. These groups can air issue ads, but not campaign ads. But the American Leadership Project is airing this ad and more in Texas and Ohio. For Clinton's struggling campaign, that's a boon.
Fully one-third of Clinton's money last year came from people who can't give her another dime for this campaign.
Sheila Krumholtz runs the Center for Responsive Politics.
Reliance on those giving the maximum or even near the maximum is a big problem ultimately for a campaign.
But those same maxed out donors can give as much as they want to this new pro-Clinton group. And Fred Wertheimer says that's just plain wrong.
We have been dealing in large part with massive violations of the campaign finance laws by individuals and groups who do not care about and are not worried about the consequences.
Wertheimer says by the time federal regulators can act, this election will be over. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The report from the Philadelphia Fed today didn't show Wall Street any brotherly love. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Bush administration is going to wait another month or two before it decides what to do next about rising foreclosure rates. Robert Steele is an undersecretary of the Treasury Department. He said today the White House wants to let the private sector try to work things out first. Nobody's going to say people losing their homes is a good thing, but commentator and community development advocate Angela Glover-Blackwell says there might just be a silver lining.
The mortgage crisis has been a disaster for many hardworking families who were striving for the American dream. Millions of Americans, especially low-income people of color, now face foreclosure. Often, home foreclosures are clustered in specific neighborhoods. This concentration can virtually hollow out communities and dramatically drive down the potential resale cost of these foreclosed properties. This is a double whammy of individual loss and neighborhood deterioration. But there's a potential upside. These low costs present an opportunity to create something that the market has not: affordable homes. Cities and towns can buy these homes for well below market value. Then they can fix them up and resell them at truly affordable prices. Covenants would require that these homes remain affordable for decades. The result? Communities could create a lasting pool of affordable housing. The experiment is already underway. Birmingham, Alabama uses a federal program to buy foreclosed homes for as little as $1 each. The homes are then refurbished and resold. This helps stop the pernicious spread of blight. This strategy isn't new. Community land trusts started in the 1960s and have popped up in more than 35 states. These nonprofit trusts buy up properties. Some are individual homes and vacant lots that have fallen into disrepair. Others have been taken over by local governments through tax liens. Land trusts renovate these properties and return them to the market at affordable prices. This helps communities across the country create a stable and reliable source of good housing for working people. The mortgage crisis has devastated families and communities across the nation, but every disaster offers opportunity. There are blueprints and tools available to rebuild our communities. Now we have to harness the creative energy to get the job done.
Angela Glover Blackwell is the founder and CEO of the Policy Link Institute based in Oakland, California. If you see a silver lining in the economic headlines, please tell us about it. Head to our website, it's marketplace.org. Click on Your Economy. Time now for the business of sports. The Super Bowl is long since over, but seasons never really end when major sports are involved. The National Football League's annual job fair started yesterday. It's also known as the Scouting Combine. It's in Indianapolis this year, a chance for college players to show the pros their stuff and for teams to put those players through their paces. Ed Dursey is here to tell us about it. Hey, Ed.
Hi, Kai.
So this is more than your average job interview, right?
Yeah, this makes the vaunted interviews at Google, Goldman Sachs, and McKinsey look pale in comparison. I mean, just imagine, there's 330 guys in Indianapolis this week. They're getting poked, prodded. And not only do they have to go through this whole process, it's public. The NFL Network is broadcasting lots of this live on television. I mean, imagine having your job interview broadcast live.
Well, I wouldn't be sitting here. What are these guys going to have to do?
Well, on the physical side, they want to measure speed, strength, and agility. So it's the 40-yard dash, the bench press, vertical jump, broad jump, shuttle runs, and a cone run for agility. And then they have to do position-specific drills. And then they go through the interview process with each of the teams to find out more about their personalities. They take physical measurements. Are you really 6 feet two, 250 pounds? Injury evaluation through a Cybex test and other things. They have to take a drug test. And then, of course, they have to take the infamous Wunderlich intelligence test.
Tell me a little bit about this test.
Well, the Wunderlich personnel test is actually taken by about 3 million people nationwide every year as part of job interviews. It's 50 questions. You have 12 minutes to do it, and it contains a range of questions from, shall we say, simple to hard.
All right, and we've got a cut, actually, from Derek Brooks. He's a linebacker at Tampa Bay about the Wunderlich.
It was like if one apple fell from a tree, two other apples fell from another tree, how many apples on the ground? Three.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, right? It can't be all that hard.
Yeah, well, but only one person in the entire history of the NFL has scored perfectly on this test. Pack McKinley of Harvard University, who went on to become a punter for the Cincinnati Bengals, scored 50, the perfect score. Now, for comparison, Eli Manning scored 39, which is considered an excellent score. Of course, Tom Brady scored only 33, so maybe that explains a little Super Bowl difference. But Eli's older brother, Peyton, only scored 28 on the test. But overall, offensive linemen do the best with an average score of 29.
Well, let me ask you, though, about this whole concept of the combine. I mean, how effective is it? You know, job interviews, by and large, work because we all get our jobs, but sometimes you wind up with clunkers, right? How does this work for the teams?
Well, clunkers in terms of do you make a bad draft pick for the money you've invested? This is very important for all of the teams. First of all, they get really all the best prospects in one place at one time, and they get to see them on, you know, an equal playing field. So for the teams, it gives them a tremendous amount of information. You know, you always have these athletes who they refer to as workout warriors, guys who've spent 3 or 4 months with, you know, personal trainers and score off the charts, but then they get into the NFL, and they're really not very effective. For the top players, years, there's probably more to lose. So guys like Darren McFadden, the running back out of Arkansas, he's probably not going to work out. He'll do that instead in a pro day at the University of Arkansas, where he can sort of shape the schedule to his liking to ensure that he does as best as he can do. It's more important from the athlete side for the guys who are going to be middle rounders, guys who people don't know about, smaller school guys who haven't been seen by all of the scouts. It's important for them because then they have a chance to move up into the higher rounds.
Which then translates into more money in their pocket.
It means more money, and especially if you get into the first round, because that's where the sort of guaranteed money through the bonuses really comes in.
All right. Ed Dursey, The Business of Sports. Thanks, Ed.
You're welcome, Kai.
Coming up, the dot-com boom gone bust.
We probably thought before, maybe a taste of humility, that everything we would touch would turn to gold.
Another conversation from the corner office, but first, let's do the numbers. A flurry of weak economic data, as I mentioned, pushed stocks lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials tumbled 1.1%, 142 points. Closed at 12,284, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ was also down 0.1%, about 27 points there, closed at 2,299. The S&P 500 fell 1.25%, 17 points, ended the day at 1,342. Energy stocks tanked after a big slide in oil prices. Shares in Chevron dropped 1.8%. Stock in ConocoPhillips sank 1.6%. ExxonMobil shares lost 1.33%. Target found itself in the crosshairs today, but bump, bump. A Citigroup analyst issued a sell recommendation, sparked a sell-off that pushed shares in the big retailer down 3.8%. An analyst upgrade gave Cisco shares an early lift, but they were pulled down as the rest of the market slumped. Cisco shares ended trading down just a fraction. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working to help reduce greenhouse gases with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org, and by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting, on the web at grantthornton.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices, calvert.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. It's the last day to vote for a new euro design. If you live in the eurozone, the new coin will commemorate the currency's 10th anniversary next year. Frank Winfield Woolworth opened the great 5-cent store in Utica, New York on February 22, 1879. He built an empire of discount chain stores that finally shuttered in 1997. And Blue Velvet actor Kyle MacLachlan turns 49. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Residential real estate's been suffering over the past year or so. That much we all know. But during the slide in home values, you kind of got the feeling commercial developers were holding their own. And it makes sense, right? Because the people doing deals for pricey office buildings aren't amateurs likely to get themselves stuck in an exploding adjustable rate mortgage. And that might be true. Still, though, Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports not all as well.
I'm standing on the edge of what's going to be a $3 billion development in downtown Los Angeles, a 1.2 million square foot hotel retail residential project. They were supposed to break ground at Christmas time after being delayed twice earlier last year. The problem is the developer can't get a loan. And when it does, it'll have to put down three times the money that it would have in recent years and pay higher interest rates. If you want to buy an existing office building, the till is tightening up there, too. With commercial real estate following residential down the drain, lenders are in no mood to take chances.
Right now, risk is a four-letter word in the financial community, and any lender is being ultra-cautious, even people that have impeccable credit.
That's Jack Kaiser of the Los Angeles Economic Development Corporation. He says just like the residential market, everyone was clamoring to get into the commercial real estate game. Banks helped things along by buying mortgages and repackaging them into bonds. But with commercial property values falling and investors running scared of real estate, nobody's buying these bonds anymore, and that means a lot less money to fund real estate deals. Mike Swarkowski works for Capital Source, a finance company. He says last year was a record year for commercial real estate, but year to date there's been a 90% dip in sales, and that's just the beginning.
All these things suggest that the market's anticipating about 185 to 200 billion of U.S. commercial real estate losses over the next several years.
Buyers who borrowed big and paid top dollar for properties are already feeling the pain. Take real estate titan Harry Macklow. He got $7 billion in short-term loans to buy marquee office buildings in New York last year as the market burned red hot. Now he's been served with a default notice. Commercial defaults aren't widespread yet as they are in residential, but Bob Bach, senior economist with Grubb & Ellis, says there's a lot of scrambling going on.
Loans are coming due, and buyers will either have to put more equity in the property or they'll have to sell or maybe renegotiate the terms with their lenders.
That's hard to do right now because of the climate of uncertainty.
Nobody's really sure about where values are going to settle.
In the end, everyone gets hit. As their borrowing costs rise, property owners will charge higher rents. That could mean slimmer profits for American companies and tighter belts for their employees. Local governments will wind up taking in less, too, as tax values and incomes decline. Bob Safai of commercial brokerage Madison Partners says it's a vicious cycle.
It affects everybody because when transactions do not occur, when people get laid off, when corporate America can't grow because they can't borrow money for growth, it takes the economy and puts a stranglehold along the economy.
And it doesn't look like the credit crunch is going to loosen its grip anytime soon. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Companies like Google and Yahoo are household names today, but how many of you remember eToys or PetSmart.com? They were just some of the companies on the leading edge of the internet economy. They were born at a high-tech incubator in Pasadena, California called Idealab. Every month back then, CEO Bill Gross was pumping out another e-commerce site. Taken together, Idealab's spinoffs were worth tens of billions of dollars. And then, of course, came the bust.
The boss will see you now.
Idealab is still around. Bill Gross is still in charge. But e-commerce and dot-coms aren't what he's into now. We'll get to what he does do in a bit. But when we sat down last week, I asked him how he knew the good times were over.
Well, it was very tough in 2000 and 2001. We definitely knew that the ride was over in terms of nobody was going to invest in companies for a long time. Certainly nobody was going to invest in internet startups.
Which is your lifeblood.
Yes. We were very fortunate that post-2001, we actually had capital that we could invest in our own companies and take them forward. We basically came up with a new theme, which was we can only start a company that we ourselves are willing to invest all the capital required to get all the way to profitability. And that led us to a much tighter criteria, which is you can't start a company a month, which is what we were doing in the early days.
Did you get greedy during the dot-com boom? Not in the monetary sense, right? Because everybody was making money and there was plenty to be made, but in the entrepreneurial sense.
I would say we got greedy in the sense that we thought we could make companies at an unbelievable rate. And we probably thought before maybe a taste of humility that everything we would touch would turn to gold. And it was great to be corrected on that because it led us to be much smarter.
There's a great quote actually about this company. The market wanted crap and so we gave them crap.
I think the market wanted speed to market and we were very good at that. And the market wanted page views, and the market wanted eyeballs. And everything the market rewarded, we learned very, very well how to make. But we learned that long-term fundamental value was the only thing that was ever going to hold up. and we learned and shifted our company to only focus on that.
What is it that you do now?
Well, we're very heavily focused on solar energy and clean tech efforts. And what we try to do is look at places around the world where we can come up with technological solutions that will get people to shift to a greener lifestyle. I don't think you're going to get people to shift to a greener lifestyle by just begging them. Right now, solar is not being adopted at a fast enough rate because it's just too expensive.
Make me smart here. What's the cost differential between a kilowatt hour of solar versus coal-powered energy?
Well, right now, you can buy electricity from the power company for probably about 13 cents a kilowatt hour on average around the United States. And solar energy costs about twice that, so maybe 26 cents a kilowatt hour. We would like to bring it down to the same price that you would pay from the power company. That's a very tall order. But if we can do that, that would allow many, many people to choose solar over their power company, over coal-produced electricity, without paying any penalty.
Now, you have some installations upstairs, right? So let's go up on the roof and check them out.
Great.
So we're up on the roof of the Idea Lab building, and what we have is a series of, I don't know, maybe two dozen or so things that look like floodlights, really, that you would see on a theater stage or something, but obviously that's not what they are. What are we seeing?
These are tracking concentrators. Each of these units wakes up in the morning when the sun comes out, turns directly toward the sun, tracks and concentrates the sunlight to a receiver, and this is how we get the cost of solar energy lower. By concentrating the sunlight, we can reduce the amount of expensive photovoltaic material to make electricity for a building.
How do you take this new technology to customers in a way that makes them say, oh, this is the way it's got to be?
We are focusing right now at Energy Innovations on larger customers, larger commercial customers, and we go to them and we take a look at their power bills. We look at a history backlog of what their expenses are. We look at the sun in their area. We have National Renewable Energy Laboratory data for the last 30 years on how much sunshine is in their particular area. And we can put forward a projection for them that will show them exactly how much money they would save. When we take a customer a savings plan like that, it really becomes a no-brainer for them to do an installation.
So when can I get one in my home?
Right now, as I said, we're focused on commercial installations because they're large and we can make the actual installation cost low. As we come up with ways to drive down the installation cost, then you absolutely will be able to get one on your home.
Bill Gross, the CEO of Idea Lab, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
We've got more of my talk with Bill Gross and other CEO interviews on our website. They're online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, just in time for the Oscars this weekend, the parent company of the show business tabloid Variety has announced it's selling off the paper. It's what you might call a media gift bag, like all those award presenters get. The Dutch company Reed Elsevier is offloading its entire media operation. That includes Farmers Weekly and New Scientist. Analysts say Reed Business Information, that's what the unit is called, could fetch £1 billion, almost $2 billion at today's rate of exchange. Reed Elsevier was apparently unhappy with the cyclical nature of the publishing business. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 142 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ dipped 27 points, 1.1% there as well. The S&P 500 dallied 17 points lower, 1.25%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Coming up next time, are you ready for that big buyout?
I'm just not ready. I'm, 55 years old, in good health, and why have to wait on a check when I can, work every day?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.